And this is KPCW. It's 8:06 on this Wednesday morning, November 5th. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Thanks for tuning in. Currently 44 degrees here in Old Town Park City under partly cloudy skies. We've got 42 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Wednesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. As we go throughout the day, you'll notice an increase in cloud cover out there. We'll call it partly cloudy skies, mostly cloudy by late this afternoon. Temperatures will climb into the mid-60s for highs in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures climbing to around 70 degrees in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Wednesday night, those clouds will continue to thicken up, and anytime after midnight, expect the chance of scattered showers to begin to develop. They'll be pushing in from Cache Valley, drifting down into the Wasatch back during the overnight hours. Most of the rain chances will occur while we're sleeping, but we'll see those showers continuing out there into early, very early Thursday morning. Overnight low temperatures will likely drop down into the mid to upper 30s in both Park City and into the Heber Valley. So most of this activity will be in the form of rain showers, but for our friends above about 7,500 feet, that's where we could see some light snow accumulation as some of that rain mixes with or changes over to snow. But for most of us, just a few morning rain showers, and then that pushes out of here during the day. We'll see with partly cloudy skies during the afternoon hours, but much cooler temperatures. Highs will only be in the upper 40s for mid to upper 40s in Park City. Highs will be in the low 50s in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Thursday night into Friday, we'll see again more clouds kind of in and out of the area. Another weak disturbance moves by on Friday. So after starting off with temperatures in the upper 20s in both Park City and the Heber Valley Friday morning, we'll see those highs back in the upper 40s in Park City and highs in the low to mid 50s in the Heber Valley. There's another very slight chance of an isolated shower rolling through on Friday, but most of us will probably stay dry with that system. As we go into the weekend, improving conditions, at least in terms of the sky, we'll see partly sunny skies out there for us both on our Saturday and Sunday. Morning low temperatures will start off below freezing on our Saturday and Sunday morning, with high temperatures in the upper 40s to right around 50 in Park City for Saturday and Sunday, with high temperatures climbing into the mid-50s here for us as we get towards the Heber Valley. Once we make our way into next week, we'll see those temperatures in the 50s for highs in Park City, 60s for the Heber Valley, with a mixture of sun and cloud. That's a good latest forecast with the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Kane.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the KPCW Local News Hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Peter Barnes with an update on some development projects throughout the county. And Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden, along with Sustainability Manager Luke Carton, preview this week's Park City Council meeting. And finally, the CEO of Vail Resorts, Rob Katz, sitting down with KPCW to talk about his new role with the company, the fallout of last year's patrol strike, and a look ahead to resort improvements ahead of the Winter Olympics. Then stay tuned for The Mountain Life. Today's guests include longevity expert Ken Stern, who reveals why the secret to a longer, healthier life isn't diet or exercise, it's connection, and how social connection is the missing link in America's health span. Then, as our clocks have been set back, science journalist Lynn Peeple explores the fascinating and often surprising science of our internal timekeepers. All of that coming up on The Mountain Life, heard, of course, every Wednesday from 9 to 10. Well, it's the day after Election Day, and here are the preliminary election results from yesterday. Just two votes separate the candidates for Park City Mayor after the first round of preliminary results. Summit County Clerk E. First says that the county saw a high turnout for a municipal election. This year's turnout, about 48%. For Park City Mayor so far, Ryan Dickey leading challenger Jack Rubin by just two votes, 1,487 to 1,485. Incumbent Park City Councilmember Tana Tolley leading the race for two council seats. That's followed by political newcomer Diego Zagara, followed by incumbent Jeremy Rubel. The margins between the council candidates range between 300 and 400 votes. The county clerk's office expects it has 500 more ballots to process and expects to release more results about 5 o'clock today. In Colville, Summit County Democratic Party Chair Rory Swenson leads Colville City Councilmember Lynn Wood in the race for mayor by about 10 votes. In Francis, incumbent Mayor Jeremy Foreman leading former Mayor Byron Ames by about a 20% margin for re-election. And the incumbent mayor in Oakley may lose his race for re-election. Zane Wolstenholme trails Councilmember Steve Woolmuth by almost 200 votes. Voters in the North Summit School District are voting on a $121 million bond for a new high school and sports facility. There were 940 against votes in the first round of results versus 775 votes in favor of. That's almost a 10% margin against the school bond so far. And in Wasatch County, voter turnout at about 47%, higher than the clerk's office has seen in recent years. Wasatch County Clerk Auditor Joey Granger released the preliminary results last night, showing that incumbent Mayor Heidi Franco was leading the Heber mayor race. Franco has more than 2,100 votes compared to Councilmember Scott Phillips, 1,900 votes. And a narrow race for the Heber City Council with incumbent Yvonne Barney and newcomer Morgan Murdoch in the lead with about 27% of the vote each. Corey Noyes and Nick Lopez each have about 23% of the vote. In Charleston, a write-in is neck and neck with Jan Wilson for mayor. Doug Clements garnered 85 votes to Wilson's 86. And in Hideout, interim mayor Ralph Severini leading Councilmember Chris Beyer by almost a 50% margin, Severini with 254 votes after election night to Byers, 98. And a 50% margin in the Midway mayoral race. Craig Simons there ahead compared to Miller Wright. Andy Garland is the top city council candidate in Midway with almost 1,300 votes. Jared Simonson finished in second with 1,100, followed by Janine Probst with 874 votes. Again, results will not be official until municipalities vote to certify their elections. They must do that by November 18th. On the phone now with an update on Summit County development projects, I have Summit County Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you today?
Doing well, thank you. Hey, let's start with any new applications that have come across your desk in the past month.
Nothing that should frighten or be of any particular significance to the public at large. We're obviously in that turn down at the end of year where planning applications start to trickle in. Chances of someone getting a building permitted, approved, and built before the freeze is about nil. So we normally get a slowdown this time of year on those projects. A few smaller projects keep coming in, obviously. Residents who, want to finish off some work on their houses, perhaps, but nothing big. Our involvement on the planning side is just a continuation of the larger projects. Building department are going, gangbusters. They're desperately trying to wrap things up before the snow falls. So they are extremely busy.
Yeah. Moving ahead, it looks like Dakota Pacific Real Estate's project is moving ahead. Where are we in the process here?
If you remember, I think you Connor has done some reporting on it. Toria Bernhardt and the Park Record. About a week ago, we actually brought the architectural design standards in front of the Planning Commission. This is a document that actually needs to be approved through the county process as part of the administrative development agreement process. It's laid out in that previously approved administrative DA. Nothing can actually be done on the project in terms of subdivisions or individual project applications until these architectural design standards have been, moved through the process and approved and are in place. The DA, the document that actually formalized the legal side of it, you could argue that establishes, the structure and the density of the projects itself in terms of what can be built and where it's generally located. The architectural design guidelines, as we discussed with our standards, as we discussed with the Planning Commission last week, really set out, the vision and character of the neighborhood that we expect to see. So that's going through that process. There was a little bit of skepticism, normal skepticism, I thought, at the Planning Commission, but on the whole, the feedback the conversation between the applicant and the Planning Commission, I thought was really positive.
Yeah, so what is the process here? I mean, does it just need Planning Commission approval, or does it eventually get back to the County Council for final approval?
It doesn't go to the County Council. It actually goes straight from the Planning Commission to the County Manager. And in theory, there's nothing of a vested right use here. This is more like the style and character detail aspect of it. But again, nothing can be done until it's approved. The process is laid out in the development agreement that's in place. That's just review by the Planning Commission, approval by the manager. There is a timetable associated with it. 45 days from original submission to approval by the planning commission, or recommendation, sorry, by the planning commission to the manager, and then it sits in front of the manager and we kind of do a quick review all over again and make sure that we dot those I's and cross those T's so we can move forward with the next phase.
Mm-hmm. So any changes to that development agreement since the original approval by county council?
Not the development agreement itself, not as yet. You know, the administrative, the architectural design standards, you know, will be tweaked as they go through. But there are one or two aspects of the DA. The Planning Commission actually did raise the question last week regarding the Kimball Arts Center. As you know, the Kimball Arts Center has expressed an interest in one of the sites in the project that's on the table. And that in itself, in terms of allocating a use of square footage, that will require, you know, what we would consider a minor amendment to the DA to fix, you know, perhaps where and what size that project's going to be and where it's going to be located. That's currently a conversation that's going on between Kimball Arts Center and Dakota Pacific. When those conversations have been formalized and revealed, we'll go through a process to take care of that.
Yeah, so what is the first phase? The Kimball Arts Center and what, parking and employee housing, workforce housing?
If you imagine what really needs first happen, what the county is interested in, because remember, this is basically a two-stage project. It's two parts. There's the joint venture part of it between the county and DPRE, where we're looking at the shared project amenities, those areas that currently is perhaps county on land or High Valley Transit on land adjacent to 224, where we're going to be looking to do a joint project where the DPRE team will be managing and constructing the shared parking structure, some infrastructure processes. As part of that, you know, we will be looking to remodel, redevelop the transit center, move our offices out of the existing Richens building, move them into the Skullcandy building. Those enabling works will take place with a high priority. I know that DPRE actually do have interest from people interested in certain aspects of the land, one of them being a medical office building on the site, which has been a high demand use for some time. Again, nothing can actually happen until we go through that phasing process of the DA. The joint venture discussions between, you know, the legal aspect of that between the county and DPRE are ongoing as we speak.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention about Dakota Pacific at this point?
Only in the fact that the architectural design standards will be back in front of the Planning Commission. Their plan return is from November 25th, that the architects went away to do some tweaks, make some changes. We're looking forward to seeing the revised document, and maybe there'll be a movement up to the county manager at that point.
Okay. Moving on, the Utah Olympic Park will be holding a few open houses in the next couple of weeks, including one tonight. Before this comes back to the Planning Commission. Talk to us a little bit about how this development agreement is changing.
This is an interesting one. The original development agreement, you know, laid out in, typically in the way most development agreements do, you know, what is actually being proposed up there, the uses, the type, the sizes, the locations. This original development agreement was done back in, I think it was 2012, I believe was the last version of this. Just before Christmas last year, perhaps around, you know, December, January time of last year, there was a proposal for a hotel that came in front of us on the site. Now, that's always been anticipated as part of the DA. The design that was laid in front of us actually, you know, we didn't have any, you know, from a planning aspect side of it, we didn't have any, you know, strong issues one way or another. But the changing location and the adjustments to the design, perhaps a more refined consideration than the original development agreement, actually required us to go back and make some changes to the DA. As part of those conversations, you know, the UOP were laying out their future ground plans, and our hope and dream was that perhaps we can roll all these into a more comprehensive adjustment to the DA. And we have had conversations with the Planning Commission at work sessions. Staff and the UOP have had lots of extensive discussions internally. There's been some Perhaps a little bit of frustration on the UOP's side as to the processes involved in going through some of these amendments, which in their view would perhaps be minor, in our view would be perhaps more major. So there is some government processing involved, the sausage-making side of it, which frustrates everyone. We have had a couple of work sessions. There was actually very little public interest until about 3 weeks ago when we actually had the first formal public hearing on the process, when there was some significant input and testimony from nearby neighbors, primarily in the Bear Hollow area, concerned about access, what the proposal does in terms of how will it impact them, can they see it, is it construction traffic, what's going on. So the traffic side of it, the use side of it, the visual impacts of it, all came to the fore about 3 weeks ago. And that's when UOP Colin Hilton, offered to set up some open houses and do some education sessions. As you say, one of which is tonight, and the next one, I believe, is scheduled for November 11th, Thursday, so a week on Thursday, between 6 and 8 at the UOP, at the Quinney Welcome Center.
Right. So what is the change in location? I had thought that this hotel was going to where the existing day lodge is, that was going to be torn.
It's essentially not significantly different, but the issue with the original DA, it established some fairly strict development areas with boundaries and slightly different. Imagine like a mini zoning map where we say we're going to assume that this site is here and this site is there and another site is over here with very specific uses. The design of the hotel actually came in with what seemed on its face a very practical and reasonable, let's reduce the footprint, slide it to one side a little. That way, in reducing the footprint, we can increase its height a little, which was allowed on one of the sites, but not on the one they were proposing to put the new relocated hotel. So that in itself required amendment to the DA. So it's not a huge change, but it was significant enough that when you slide it across a boundary line on a predetermined envelope on a development agreement, we actually have to go through a process of changing that. Will be reviewed. The final design is not approved through this development agreement. The design itself will be approved through a subsequent process.
Yeah, so in addition to the hotel, what else is being proposed?
Just more of the same. If you imagine, the UOP would call these athlete support services, athlete housing, workforce housing for the UOP, typical buildings of a type that would use in running something like, imagine at the canyons, you have, many buildings and uses that are not actually associated necessarily with high public use or density uses, but do involve how do you run an Olympic Park? Well, you need storage facilities, you need maintenance facilities, you need support facilities for the existing offices. If you're moving an office from one location to another at this point, will we be building, say, small cafeteria restaurant? Does the hotel come with like a small conference facility? The recreation aspect of it, the pools will be upgraded. It's actually a fairly ambitious and complex set of planning. And I would advise anyone who's interested definitely to try and attend one of these public open houses. Colin Hilton and the team at UOP have been very forthcoming in trying to describe what they're trying to do. We, on our side, are trying to get extremely specific so we can define the legal side of it. And that's where the frustration creeps in between. There's no fundamental disagreements here.
Okay. And again, this comes back to the Planning Commission on November 25th. You had a visit to the Junction Commons, the outlets, looking for a Planning Commission recommendation soon as well, huh?
Yeah, would actually be if it all went in accordance with the plan of the applicants, of course, it would be the first successful rezone to what we've been calling the Neighborhood Mixed Use Zone, NMU1, which allows a degree of flexibility that current zoning for that site doesn't allow. They've been in the process a long time, going through many iterations and many work sessions of the Planning Commission. It is significant in terms of, there's a major change to, use, density, and height within the project. The last time this was at the project, at in front of the Planning Commission, I think it was 3-4 weeks ago, it was like, okay, we're looking favorably towards a recommendation to a rezone to the council, but there's still a little bit of nervousness involved. Essentially, at the time, was about the height of the project. This would propose buildings up to 65 feet high. That's allowed in the NMU zone. But that is clearly the impacts of a development of that nature are clearly based on context. Where is it? How is it located? So the site visit last week was very much to go and, you know, what is the height of the existing buildings, measurements. You know, in the old days, we used to float balloons over Main Street to check the height of buildings. So some fairly simple observations of what was going on, a tour of the Planning Commission. There was no deliberation on the project. There was just questions and clarifications. And we're looking to be back in front of the Planning Commission ASAP. I don't think we have a set date. I think the earliest date probably December 9th, but if people don't hold me to that, if you reach out, we'll be able to confirm it. But the Planning Commission, I think, generally were receptive, but obviously there's a little bit of nervousness about such a significant change.
Okay. Finally, the first two floors of the Canyons parking garage are set to be finished, I believe, by November 21st. Is that going to happen?
This has been extraordinary progress, a great deal of teamwork on everybody's part, and a not insignificant amount of patience and frustration from some nearby residents. So, you know, I'd like to thank those people for putting up with seeming chaos of a high-pressure work schedule. The contractor has actually done a tremendous job keeping on time. Our building inspectors, essentially full-time building inspector, you know, sometimes, you know, working, you know, late, early, and, you know, on and off at weekends to get things done. So it's been a tremendous amount of teamwork. I believe there's actually a meeting scheduled today to get the interested parties, building inspectors, fire department, engineering, transportation, the team from Canyons, to run through what is going to be expected before we can actually issue the certificate of occupancy. Obviously, the ski resort has their D-Day. We want this thing up and running and ready for use, so everyone has an enjoyable ski season.
Okay, I got to leave it there. Peter, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Leslie. Bye now.
Peter Barnes is Summit County Community Development Director. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. The Park City Council meets Thursday with a full agenda. In the studio to preview the agenda, I have Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden, along with Sustainability Manager Luke Carton. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see, Heather, with the new mayor and possibly one new council member, do changes mean anything for the staff going forward here?
You know, I think this has been an exciting election. We've got a very tight mayoral race, as I'm sure your listeners have seen, and some initial and unofficial results with respect to the city council race. I think we're just excited to welcome the newly elected and reelected officials once they come in, and we'll see. But we've got to wait for the results to finish coming in and see how it goes.
Okay. For Thursday's meeting, work session starts at 4 o'clock with an update from UDOT on the long-range planning study for US 40. No staff report with this since UDOT's presenting, but how is Park City involved in this? I mean, are we talking about, what, US 40 to the county line, US 40 to 248?
Yeah, and to your point, Leslie, UDOT's been engaged in this ongoing corridor study of US 40, analyzing the mobility needs as the region grows, and they're just now in the process of finalizing their proposed recommendations for that stretch of US 40 between the I-80 interchange and River Road. They expect to wrap up by the end of the year with their list of recommendations and priorities for future multimodal connections. But because Park City's been engaged in this broader community conversation around transportation, growth, and development, particularly with respect to the Clark Ranch affordable housing development on that west side of US 40, and then the long contemplated conservation easement that's straddling US 40, we invited UDOT to this meeting on November 6th to share an update on their corridor study and recommendations now, so we can get that information out to the public and have it discussed in the context of these other important city projects.
Yeah, and certainly some improvements have been made that have been great, such as getting onto US 40 from the Park City side, but we still have that cluster coming from eastbound I-80 to US 40, especially on Fridays, and going from US 40 to I-80 over the you know, the flyover from two lanes to one lane, always causing traffic now. So are those choke points part of this study?
I think they're going to be discussing all of that in their presentation, Leslie. So we're looking forward to that.
So is the plan to get all of this work done once we decide what's going to be done before the Olympics?
You know, I don't know what their plan is in terms of timing, but I do know one of their key goals is to improve local road connections, which will include frontage roads, to help preserve freeway capacity for regional travel. So by the end of the year, we should see those priorities, and they'll be incorporating them into their long-range transportation plan.
Okay. At 4:30, a work session on the senior center design. The city has hired a designer and architect to do what exactly?
They're Sperano and Mooney Architects is who we've hired through our procurement process, and they're going to lead a work session with the City Council to review some conceptual site designs for the new Park City Center on the Mulroney lot. And we anticipate their discussion is going to focus on the building placement and space programming, parking and access options, some open space considerations, and the cost. And we've really been collaborating closely with the Park City Seniors and City Hall to really ensure the facility meets both community and council goals.
Okay, so really nothing's been determined at this point in terms of the size of the building, where it gets placed?
Correct. We have been directed, or rather our partner has been directed, to come back to the council with some focus on parking considerations, whether we want to build a surface lot or an underground lot or maybe a combination of both of those. They want to focus on the space programming that the seniors desire for the space, and those will really help refine not only the budget for the senior center, but also the size.
Yeah, and when we talk about cost, how much has the city set aside for this?
You know, that's going to be a discussion that the council's going to have. I don't think there's clear direction yet on exactly what that number's going to be. We've wanted to kind of figure out some of these initial items first. And, of course, the county is part of the discussion with respect to the senior center. We had a meeting with them on Monday, and to continue those conversations about a possible county contribution.
Okay. And taking a look at the sales tax report for August, it looks like things are looking good there.
They are. The August sales tax distribution is actually the highest we've had on record. We've got sales tax revenues up about 12.5% over last year, nearly 10% above budget. So that's great news, but I just want to caution our listeners that this is partly driven by the timing of state distributions. So it's not it's a snapshot in time, but we really tend to look at more long-range trends and goals as we decide on our budget. But we are seeing stable spending conditions through the end of the summer months.
Yeah, now what about the transit room tax? Because it looks like the numbers are almost up 2%, but down from what the city had budgeted for. So how does that impact current year budget?
That's true. We've seen that monthly gain for us is just suggests some lodging activity remains generally stable, but it's not returned to our prior record levels. I think right now we're seeing that with what we anticipate for September shows visitation levels roughly consistent with the same period last year. So with 2 months into our fiscal year 2026, we think we're off to a solid start.
Okay. Luke, let's take a look at the Clark Ranch conservation easement. My understanding is the plan is to take about 20 acres from the 340-acre easement. The Keep Clark Ranch Wild Group says that the City Council previously gave very clear policy direction. So it sounds like the developer is not sticking to that, or are they?
No, definitely. It's a great time to clear these things up, too. There's a lot of questions going around in the community and information and interest in how do conservation easements work, how do they, you know, balance out development or truthfully prohibit development. So take a half step back. Clark Ranch, bought by the city back in 2014, went through 7 different COSAC meetings for recommendations plus a site visit. There was also a work session in March of 2016 as well, where the council, you know, discussed it with COSAC. There was a great discussion. Again, you can read through the minutes, but also it paused there. And that just happens sometimes, you know, when you look at Clark Ranch is moving along and then things like Bonanza Flat came up and Treasure Hill came up in that side of it. So the Clark Ranch conservation easement was kind of put on the back burner. And then council and Mayor Nan asked staff to bring it back forward, breathe some new life back into it. So it's the total Clark Ranch is 340 acres, 340.56. The the goal on this is a very typical conservation easement, allow recreation, aesthetics. So again, read through that side. The area that we're looking at for city needs, it was affectionately called Steve Point after our previous city council member, Steve Joyce. So the COSAC recommendation was a 10-acre carve out for, you know, city needs. The interesting thing too is those recommendations, that discussion happened before there were even shovels in the ground on the Park City Heights side of it. So right now we have to look at the real world implications of it, right? We have neighbors that back directly up to this carved out kind of triangle. So what we tried to do is to balance the community needs, the COSAC intent, and also figure out how we can continue to move projects forward. So what staff is coming forward to council with is a 15-acre carve-out. And what we're actually going to suggest to council is to allow up to 10 acres of developable land and then put the other 5 acres into publicly available open space that will have a deed restriction on it. There's ways to do that. And the reason we're doing that is to still hold true to the COSAC intent, but also be able to allow to provide a buffer against the existing neighbors that are there. And also, you know, with that buffer between the any potential development that goes in there and the conservation easement too, to give a little bit of an open space buffer too. So that way we can still have projects move forward that balance the community needs and is also kind of give a nod to the neighbors to be able to create a buffer between the two.
So is that the plan though, that 5 acres forever remains a open space buffer?
That's what staff is suggesting to council. And again, what we're trying to do is, I don't want to lose the forest through the trees as well, right? The Clark Ranch Conservation Easement has sat out there for 10 years. It's 325 acres right now as proposed. And my goal is to say, all right, are we good with the conservation easement language piece, right? And now we're down to a 1% decision of, is this 5 acres a part of the locked-in conservation easement, or do we tie it towards the open space side? And I think it's just a question of letting council make that decision, right? They're the policymakers, and again, just provide that direction. If they say, hey, completely change us, we're up for it too. But the other goal is we wanted to bring it to a vote because we want to try to move this forward. We just didn't want to work session it for another 10 years until another decision has to be made.
Yeah, okay. So the residents' fears that they're going to be a bigger development than that was actually promised, or that the development is going to expand beyond the original 10 acres are not correct.
Exactly. I think that the issue is, right, everyone's trying to look back to 10 years ago of notes, right? The 7 COSAC meetings, I've read through the over 10 and a half hours of meeting notes and that side of it too. And again, you can say, well, this person said this, or this was the intent of that. But we also have to live in the here and now too. So we're trying to balance the kind of 10-acre development need, tie the rest into open space so we don't create small little orphan parcels, but also truthfully help give city council a point to give feedback on. So we, again, clear up all of these misconceptions or misunderstandings or just fear of the unknown.
Okay. Let's move on to the Bonanza 5 acres. This will be the 6th meeting with the developer here. Until they get clear direction from the council, they cannot file an application. So what are they looking for from the council to make a decision on?
You know, we're actually pleased with the progress we've been making on this project, and we got some direction from the last meeting, and I think we're just getting at a few more decisions to get us ready to take the project to the Planning Commission. But at the last meeting, a majority of council gave direction on 3 stories across the development, with 4 stories on building one that's near the corner of Woodbine and Munchkin. They're okay with approximately 106 to 112 units to fit the updated design. They're generally okay with the mix of uses that are proposed for the Village Green between tenant services, retail, and art space, with a few adjustments and considerations that the council has raised that we anticipate Bringer will come back to address. They also raised some concerns, questions regarding the 4-bedroom units and whether or not those are needed with the workforce and AMI mixes that the council is trying to achieve. That will be a further discussion point, I think, at this meeting. The council also directed that a majority are not in favor of a splash pad on the Village Green, so we anticipate some additional decisions with respect to that will come forward. So they're looking for just some refinement of some of these last decisions, particularly on the AMI mix and the particular unit types that are going to be in the the project and the exact kind of footprint of where we're going to land. And I think once we've got those decisions made, the council will be in a position that they can recommend the project to go to the Planning Commission.
Okay, this agenda item is listed as possible action. Is that possible, do you think?
It is possible. We'll see.
All right. And finally, a last-minute addition to the agenda includes a SNAP allocation. Tell me about this.
Yes. As your listeners likely know, with the federal government shutdown, federal SNAP benefits have been disrupted as of November 1st. So the council directed at the last meeting that they were really interested in providing funding to support our SNAP recipients here in Park City. So the council will be considering a $60,000 funding increase for the Christian Center of Park City to expand food assistance in response to that SNAP benefit disruption. There are around 150 Park City households, about 4% of the community, that lost access to these benefits as of the beginning of the month. And the Christian Center of Park City is the region's largest food pantry. They've already scaled up operations, activated volunteers. They're ready to purchase additional food to meet the surge in demand. So that's what we're trying to do here, is to provide some additional funding for our SNAP benefits.
Okay, and that would only go to residents living within the city limits?
That is correct.
Okay, so that would be checked at the Christian Center then?
You know, those details I'm not sure of. But I do know what we're hoping to achieve is getting these food orders for our recipients here in Park City.
Okay, how soon can that happen?
That is a good question. I don't know the answer to that, Leslie. I have to follow up.
Guess it has to be approved first.
Correct.
Okay, Luke, Heather, I need to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. A Park City Mountain Ski Patrol strike last Christmas led to a lot of negative publicity and poor operational performance during one of the busiest times of the ski season. It dropped Vail Resort stock price and skier visits, and likely the precursor to the ousting of former Vail Resort CEO Kirsten Lynch. Today, that job belongs to Rob Katz, who served in that role between 2006 and 2021. He joins me now in the studio to talk about the coming season, what's ahead with the 2034 Olympics. Good morning, and thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so what brings you to Park City?
Meeting with the team here, meeting with the senior team. There's a welcome back event that I'm going to be participating in and speaking at, meeting with some community folks, beginning what I love the most, actually, which is coming to the resorts, is why I came back.
Yeah, so why was it important that you're here at Park City, though, right?
Well, it's one of our most important resorts. And so as I started this, I was actually in the Northeast visiting Stowe Okemo and Mount Snow. I was in Whistler yesterday. And Park City was next to be here and see everybody and see the resort.
Okay. So a lot of us, and I think especially women, were rooting for Kirsten Lynch to succeed at Vail Resorts. Was it the timing, just a lack of understanding of the company, just bad luck that kind of led to her resignation?
Yeah, Kirsten and I have worked together for 14, 15 years, and I have an incredibly high regard for her. And that said, I think the board made a decision that it was time for a change, just given the environment and what was going on, and reached out to me to ask whether or not I'd come back to do it. And I felt like, yeah, this was something that I've been passionate about, you know, almost my entire working life. I wanted to come back, and help make a difference.
Yeah. So is this permanent for you, or are, you know, the board looking for somebody to replace? I mean,
yeah, I think it's permanent. I'm not sure. I was in the role last time for 16 years. I'm not sure I'll be in the role for another 16 years because I've gotten a little older along the way, but it's permanent.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, I mean, is that something that you're working on as CEO
to look for
a replacement?
Not right now. No, I think we're focusing on, how we improve things around the company. I'm supporting the team that we have right now.
All right. Many locals, I think, feel that Vail Resort's focus on shareholder returns comes at the expense of the community, the employees, the guests. I guess, how do you balance profit with declining on-mountain experiences? I mean, what do you say to those who believe that Vail Resorts has put profits over people?
Yeah, I strongly would disagree with that. I think that when you look at our track record over how we support the people who work at Vail Resorts, the career progression that has happened across our company in terms of people being able to really follow their passion and do better and get more seniority and more responsibility within our company. I think the support that we do have for the communities and the relationship that we have with all the communities, I think, speaks to that. And in the end, If we have a declining on-mountain experience, that is not good for profits. There is actually a much stronger alignment between people, community, and profits, and I think people understand. We only succeed when all of those things go well. And it's true that sometimes things don't go as we had hoped, and then we have to learn from that and do better.
Yeah, so what steps is the company taking to hopefully improve guest satisfaction?
Yeah, I think, one, I think we really need to understand that the guest experience starts from the moment people, you know, are communicating or learning about our company online. And guest communication, just like community communication, is very important, especially when things go off track, so to speak. You need to be communicating with your guests. So that's something that we intend to put a lot of focus in to make sure that we do better. We also want our guest experience to be more consistent. And we don't want events that happen like the Park City Patrol strike last year, which, yeah, it was something that none of us at the company wanted to have happen. And we need to be more consistent throughout the year around that. And we need to make skiing more accessible. I think we have spent a lot of time focusing on passes that we sell before the season. We've done an amazing job at that. But lift tickets now have to be a focus, right? We have to bring in those people who don't make a decision before that early December deadline.
So are we going to see a reduction in that? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, at certain resorts. We are actually implementing reductions this year. Keystone and Breckenridge both have reductions in their lift ticket prices this year. But we have to be thoughtful about it, too, because we need to manage that versus crowding. And so we are, it's not, you will not see us have a kind of blanket reduction. What we want to do is be strategic. Where are the times during the season where actually we do need and have capacity? We want to bring people in. I think as we get into December, we're going to be announcing some new things to try and even further shift kind of how we market lift tickets to people.
So will we see that at Park City?
You will.
Skier and riders often complain about the long lift lines there at the base, but also at the major collector areas. Of course, Tombstone, Silver Lode, Jupiter 9990 on a powder day. What are the company's plans to fix that, or can you?
Well, I think one of the things obviously we're focused on is upgrading lifts and investing in lifts to increase their capacity, turn them into a high-speed lift. I think when you look across especially our biggest resorts like Park City, we've put huge amounts of money, right, into the resorts to upgrade lifts. Obviously, we still have an interest in upgrading the two lifts that we identified a few years back here. I'd also say that, look, every part of travel on a peak week, on a peak day, on a bluebird powder day, you're going to have a line. I mean, that is a reality, and I think not something that we all collectively as a community want to solve completely, because then we'd be, you know, building the church for Easter. So ultimately, the question is it something that's reasonable given the circumstances? And I think for us, we're constantly looking at that. When you look across our company, 97% of our lift lines, right, are under 10 minutes. I started skiing in the 80s. Lines were much, much longer than they ever are today just because the lifts were slower. So the experience, I think, is much better today than it was in the past. But to keep that up, we have to keep investing.
So what is the deal with replacing the Eagle and the Silver Lode lifts on the Park City side of the resort? As you know, of course, the lifts were ordered, sat in the parking lot, and then shipped off to Whistler.
Yes, that was not great. And we're thrilled that they're at Whistler, but that doesn't take away the fact that we think they would have been important and still are important to put in Park City. So we do intend to come back and apply for those lifts and, you know, try and get the replacement and start a new dialogue with the community about what that might look like.
Yeah. So tell me about that process, though. I mean, are you going to begin the process that everybody, including, I believe, the four original citizen appellants, have been pushing for to apply for or amend or update that 1998 development agreement?
Well, I don't want to prejudge exactly what the process is. Obviously, ultimately, it'll be the planning commission and the council that will decide what the process is for each of those lifts and what the dialogue should be around that. I just feel like ultimately, improving the guest experience, us investing in this community, I think makes sense. And I think we want to find a way to do that. And, of course, bring everyone in the community along to see the benefit of that.
Yeah. Well, can you give us an idea of when that might happen, that those lifts could be installed?
Well, I can say that we're looking over the upcoming months to make the application. Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, when it actually goes in will be somewhat about, yeah, how that process goes.
What about the development on the resort parking lots after Peg walked away from the deal a few years ago? We've heard nothing.
Yeah, I think that's something that we very much want to take the next steps on. And, you know, I think it goes along with maybe the lifts as well, which is getting community buy-in, having the right conversations to understand, right, you know, where the community wants to go with a site like that, what's important to them. You know, we had a lot of things in that project plan, just like with the lifts, in terms of improving parking, in terms of improving transportation, you know, and transit dynamics. And so all of that, I think, is important. You know, we also have the Olympics coming up, as you mentioned at the top. So I think, you know, what do we want to do or try and get done before that, I think, becomes important as well. I think our company remains as committed as ever. But of course, we understand that it has to be something that the community comes together and, you know, can get behind.
Yeah. So when are these conversations with the community going to happen?
Over time. I mean, I think, you know, we are constantly in communication and dialogue with folks within the community. And that's something that, you know, we're going to continue to do and I'm going to personally do. But yeah, we understand that in the end, there's a formal process for all of these things that we have to go through. And you know, but there's no point in starting a formal process unless you have a sense, right, that there's some path.
Well, and, you know, the clock's ticking, right? I mean, we do have an Olympics coming in 9 years. And when you look at the work that would be involved in redeveloping those parking lots, I mean, is that something you do want to show off for the Olympics or do you just let it be?
I think our company absolutely wants to show that off. I think the question is, you know, for the community, what do they want to show off as well? And so I know that, you know, there's going to be a number of things, I'm sure, that the community is going to engage in to prepare for what's going to be an incredible moment for Park City and the entire community.
Moving on. Park City resident Matthew Prince, co-owner of the Park Record, expressed interest in purchasing Park City Mountain Resort, claiming he could operate it better. Vail Resort says the resort isn't for sale, but as I asked Deidre Walsh, there is the notion that everything is for sale depending on the price. So is there a price?
No, there's not a price. I think really flattering, and I so appreciate, you know, Matthew's enthusiasm for the resort and his passion for the community and... Yeah, I, of course, there are people who would like to buy things. But ultimately, I think it's a bit of a distraction in that we should be collaborating with him and many other people within the community about how to make the community better. And if people have ideas about how we could run the resort better or things that we could do different, yeah, we're fully open to that, to him and to lots of guests, lots of people in the community. And we take that all in and we're constantly trying to improve.
How do people do that? I mean, if they've got some say and how they think the resort should move forward.
Yeah, they absolutely should reach out to, one, we have for all of our guests, we're constantly surveying our guests and taking feedback and taking comments rigorously throughout every single season. But people can reach out to, yeah, the entire Park City team here. I know they would love to hear from folks about, and obviously it sounds like they could get on air or they could be in the newspaper. And of course, our teams are always, and so am I, right, reading and listening to what people are saying.
Yeah, so why is Park City Mountain so important to Vail Resorts?
It's one of the most incredible world-class resorts in the, you know, on the planet. I mean, it is an amazing ski experience, an amazing community. It has had tremendous growth, right, over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years, or actually if you go all the way back to the Olympics in 2002. And I think that's because of the unique experience. And that's not just about the mountain. That is absolutely about what's going on in the community. The vibrancy of the community is critical to us because I think that's what differentiates it from a lot of other resorts. When you talk to people about why they come, sure, the skiing is important, but it is the rest of the time that they spend here that matters.
So have you met with Matthew Prince?
I have not, no.
No, because as the owner of the Town Live Plaza, I mean, seems like you'd be working together to figure out how to bring people up to the mountain from the plaza.
Yeah, and my understanding is he has absolutely met with other folks on our team, and I know, you know, folks who work for him have met with, you know, our folks. So, yeah, absolutely important dialogue there about what we could do that's better and what makes sense for the community on that front and any other front that we want to talk about.
All right. And I guess it's time running out here. What's your personal commitment, CEO, to make sure that there's not a repeat of last season, or at least the beginning of it?
Yeah, I think, you know, look, I think last year was something that absolutely we don't want to repeat. And I think was, yeah, we have ownership of, yeah, things that we could have done better and things that we could do differently. I think when you look back over time, our company, Vail Resorts, has had a union ever since we bought the Canyons, because the Canyons had a ski patrol union before we bought it. We have negotiated, you know, a number of contracts with different groups at different resorts, all very successfully. So, you know, this one stood out. I think, you know, yeah, there are things we've learned about how to better prepare for a moment like that. But of course, the biggest thing is we don't want those moments to happen. I think even after the Park City situation, right, we successfully have negotiated contracts at Keystone, at Crested Butte, at Park City with lift maintenance, all without issue. And so that's certainly our goal going forward.
Yeah, and certainly with the unions of Ski Patrol and lift maintenance, I mean, are the lifties next?
I don't know. Obviously, our company's view is that we think the best way to operate the resort is when we have a direct relationship, you know, with our employees. That said, we completely respect the right for employees if they want to unionize. That's something that, you know, ultimately is up to them. But we don't think it necessarily adds overall to the mix. And I think we have made huge investments in wages, you know, $175 million in wages just a couple of years ago, because we understand that to run our business well, we have to be at the forefront of getting the best talent. That's important to us.
Yeah. So as you know, serving in that position for 16 years and then kind of walking away for it, do you bring as CEO something different in the way that you operate the company than you did your prior term?
I think so. I've gotten a little older, a couple more gray hairs along the way, have had some life experience, and I think some perspective. You know, having, I had spent a lot of time, you know, in this company and through a lot of, you know, crazy, you know, kind of challenging situations at times, including in Park City when we first did the acquisition. I think I come back to it with a little bit of maturity and perspective and an understanding that I have tremendous pride in our company. It doesn't mean that we can't make mistakes. It doesn't mean that there aren't things that I wish we could do differently. But I have so much, just affection for the people who work here, the job that they do. When I look across everyone in this, you know, who works at the resort here in Park City, huge, huge admiration. And to me, my job is to make their job easier and overall to, yeah, try and bring better alignment, as we talked about earlier, between our stakeholders.
All right. Anything else you want to say?
No, I'm good. I you know, super excited for the upcoming season. I think there's a lot to be, interested in as we look to the future of the ski industry. I think it'll look a little different than what it has over the last 4 to 5 years. And, you know, that's something that I'm really passionate about helping to bring about.
All right. And for somebody who didn't buy a pass, stay tuned for some announcement next month. Is that what you're telling me?
No, I'm saying I think if you want to ski this season, the thing to do is to buy a season pass before the deadline that's coming up in November, because that's always going to be your best price. But for somebody who misses all the deadlines and can't buy that pass, we're going to, yes, make it easier for you. But it's never going to be better than buying right now.
Okay. Rob Katz, CEO of Vail Resorts. Appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Lizzie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.